Succession number 20486, reel 3.
Wing Commander Young, Reel 3. You were just about to tell me about this glorious day in
yes,
July.
Yes, July.
Can you tell me what job you were doing, please?
I was the leader of Yellow Section 249 at immediate readiness. In other words, I was all togged up and sitting in my aeroplane with the battery cart connected and an airman waiting to start it and so on, with another Hurricane on either side. Yeah? And I was on the ground at Leconfield, and in front of me there was John Randy marching to and fro, and behind me the Germans were taking the hell out of Driffield behind me, and bangs and smoke and everything going on. And I said to John, can't I take off and orbit the airfield? And John said to me, John, you are aware of the policy of limited response as well as I am. He said, if you don't shut up, I'll take you off readiness. And so we just let the Germans take the hell out of Driffield. And they destroyed about 20 airplanes. And we just let them. With the idea that they would consider that north of England was insufficiently defended. And of course, on August the 15th, they mounted a major operation towards Driffield and lost 40% of their effectives, which was a completely unacceptable rate of loss. We had no casualties.
Can you tell me about being at readiness, what it involved, please?
Yes. Readiness itself meant that you were togged up in your May West. Your aeroplane was all ready for instant departure, probably with the parachute in the seat, and you were expected to be airborne operational in 4 minutes. Instant readiness meant that you were sitting in your aeroplane with your helmet on, probably with the door to one side of your cockpit open, windshield slight slid back, ready to just listen on the radio for startup and signal to your airman, battery, and the aircraft would fire.
What do you mean, battery?
Oh, Spitfires and Hurricanes were turned at that time by an external battery. There was a large external battery to supplement the aircraft's own battery. It was only in later years that Spitfires and Hurricanes started themselves, with the improvement in battery technology and the greater capacity of the battery that could be fitted in an airplane.
So at instant readiness, you were sitting in the cockpit?
Yes, waiting with your radio switched on, waiting for scramble to be done over the RT.
But when you were just at readiness, you weren't in the aeroplane?
No, you were sitting in the dispersal hut, waiting with your May West on, all ready to be airborne, operational in 4 minutes.
What was it like in the dispersal hut?
Oh, very chummy. You had beds and everything just to, in 603's dispersal hut at Aberdeen, We used to have lunch and everything, and it was very nice. We had the old flying club building at Dyce Airport.
And what about in 249 Squadron?
In 249 at Leconfield, I can't remember. At Church Fenton, I remember we had a hut, dispersal hut. But at Leconfield, I can't. Maybe tents, I'm not sure.
And so, in the dispersal hut at Church Fenton, it wasn't primitive?
Well, not utterly primitive, no. There was a telephone and there was a lavatory and things like that, yes. In 609, when I did a little spell with 609 at Drem in 1939, we had a caravan on the far side of the airfield. A large caravan.
You must have seen these Battle of Britain films where the Battle of Britain is depicted.
Yes.
Where they're waiting in readiness.
Yes.
Is all that accurate?
Pretty good. Well, I hope so. I helped.
You advised the film.
I helped Tom Gleave, who was my predecessor as historian of the association, yes.
You helped the filmmakers?
Tom Gleave advised, we had a talk beforehand, yes. Yes. And the Bader film, Reach for the Sky, is a pretty good evocation of not only Bader, but how he behaved and everything else.
Did you know Bader?
Yes, I did.
When did you get to know him?
Well, he came through Church Fenton when he took over 242 Squadron, just for a couple of days. Yes.
And you got to know him in those 2 days?
No, not really, but I was subjected to his charisma, shall I say, for a moment or two.
What did that amount to?
Oh, he was a ebullient personality, and I remember him getting out of a hurricane at Church Fenton. One couldn't not, as it were, be impressed.
What were you so impressed by?
Well, just, as I said earlier, his charisma.
But can you describe his charisma?
Well, yes, it was sort of the epitome of leadership. Yes.
But I never met him, so can you bring it to life?
Well, yes, he was ebullient. He was, you know, sort of full of life and very nice. As far as the Douglas Bader controversy goes, of course, that is a much deeper question, where we have the whole of Britain divided into how the German menace should be faced. We've already touched on this with Hugh Dowding's Fabian tactics, set in stone almost, but of course there was this gallant band of warriors surrounding Duxford that epitomised the part of the country that felt that the Germans should be confronted with bravura, as it were. Yeah. And of course, Bader was, as it were, that type of thing personified.
Which side of the divide did you stand on?
Oh, I stood on the Fabian side. I knew it couldn't be done. I knew the bravado, the bravura side could not prevail.
Even at that time, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yes.
So John Grandy, on that occasion at Leconfield, didn't really have any need to tell you to...
Well, he did. Well, he did and he didn't. Because, remember, I had not... volunteered to contravene the order. I had simply asked whether I might anticipate the order to go. You see, I didn't ask permission to engage the enemy. I asked to be allowed to go into a position which would have been more convenient to engage the enemy.
So when Bader visited Church Fenton,
yes,
did his difference of opinion about policy come across?
Oh, no, not at that time. No, no.
Was that before the Battle of Britain?
Yes. Oh, yes, well before. He took over in June, I think. 242 had had a bad time in France, and he took over. I don't quite know what happened, but the COs, I believe they'd lost confidence in their commanding officer. And this was not unusual.
Why?
Well, there was a considerable turnover in commanding officers. As I said earlier, sergeant commanders, fighter pilots, are not... The selection of them is not... by any means understood. And while the general qualifications seem to be understood, what really happens when the chips are down is hard to forecast. I've been involved in recent years in an Air Force effort to try and epitomize this, and I encapsulate this. And I remember talking to Chris Fox to Norris about it, and he said, "Well, John, I think the man's on a what not to nothing, you see." And I said, "Well, I'm trying to agree with you."
A beating to nothing.
A beating to nothing. Yes. Yes.
Meaning that he wouldn't make it.
He wouldn't ever be able to encapsulate what is required. Remember that the duties of an Air Force squadron commander are to lead from the front when the chips are down.
For a fighter pilot CEO?
Yes. He leads it from the front.
Going back to that incident where you said that you went after a German recce plane.
Yes.
Did you get it?
No, we didn't. What happened was that they were very alert, and my number two made a mistake. What he did was we were upsun of the man, and he had exceedingly good eyesight, as I did. I'd seen him. He saw him, and rather than break hearty silence, he started waggling his wings, you see, like this. And of course the sun reflected, and the man suddenly went chuff underneath us, and I ordered echelon starboard and went down, but we didn't catch him. He went into cloud.
And that was in July?
Yes. And of course... going down so quickly, I quickly found myself in real major sinus trouble, and you know, my whole front covered in blood and everything else, and yes, unhappy.
And this was over Yorkshire?
That was over Yorkshire, yes. From Church, somewhere in central Yorkshire, east of Church Fenton. Eventually I managed to get down at Church Fenton, and I was treated by an ENT specialist who flew over from York Hospital, I think, Australian.
What did he do for you?
Oh, he filled my, he washed my face, filled my nose with cocaine, inserted steel, stainless steel tubes in my sinus tubes, washed me out, and then flew me to York Hospital for a final whatnot, and flew me back.
Was it painful for you?
No, because my nose was anaesthetized with cocaine.
But, I mean, afterwards?
No, not really. It took some time, well, it took a long time for the inflammation of my inner ear to stop. And, of course, I was grounded, not grounded, but limited to flying above 2,000 feet until September 1940. In September 1940, I was suddenly posted to be the instructor to 306 Squadron, Polish Squadron, on secondment, really, from 249, who by then had gone south. And I had a Polish CO called Rolski, who was exceedingly able. I'd been posted to the Poles for the same reason that Buzicellet had been posted. I was supposed to have good French, you see. You know, university and all that sort of rubbish. And Buzi was also supposed to have fluent French. And both of us found, of course, that no Poles spoke French. They spoke German or Russian. Or one or two spoke French. Not many. And what I did was I had the Central Flying School patter translated into Polish. And I learnt it like a Shakespeare play. And I taught flying in Polish at Church Fenton.
What about flying did you have to teach them?
Oh, how to fly, how to handle the Merlin engine, how to to check that they could to learn how to handle the British blind flying panel. Their basic flying was superb, but of course their knowledge of the blind flying. None of them had flown at night, and of course their knowledge of a defensive weapons system, such as the British possessed with radar and whatnot, was nil. All that had to be taught.
What did you have to teach them about the blind flying panel?
Well, they had never seen one before. They had to be told, shown on the ground how to use it, and they had to. We had a dual airplanes, in which they were shown how to coordinate the use of the instruments.
What does a blind flying panel look like?
Oh, it's the six instrument panel, you know, the T-shaped six instrument panel, which is standard today, which was, of course, fitted to all British fighters and light bombers of the time, training airplanes, light bombers of the time.
What exactly did you have to teach them about the Merlin engine?
Well, handling the Merlin engine, they'd never flown a water-cooled engine. You see, there was the radiator, controls, the constant speed or variable pitch prop, they never handled that. There was quite a bit to do. Remember, they'd only flown propeller-driven aeroplanes with wooden propellers.
Before we leave 249 Squadron, have you got any more Battle of Britain memories with them?
Well, not really. Of course, tried night interceptions with 249, and found, of course, the weather in Yorkshire exceedingly difficult, because at night, as you know, on a summer night, the low stratus comes in over Yorkshire. You'll be a Yorkshireman very well, and we found that very difficult to deal with. People didn't understand, as it were, it's what's called the ha, isn't it? Yes. That was the great difficulty, really, with 249, was assessing when we could do flying training. And of course, these people had come from FTS and OTU and had little or no night flying experience. Or, no, let's put it, they had minimal night flying experience.
Did you shoot any German planes down yourself?
Not in the battle, no. I had fired at a number of German aeroplanes when I was in 603 Squadron, but that was mainly on convoy protection, where no complete interception was possible, simply because we were not allowed to go more than 10 miles from the convoy. You might come up towards somebody trying to interfere with the convoy, engage him and splatter him from some distance away, but by that time he turned tail and your duty was to return to the convoy, not to intercept.
And so with 249,
yes.
You were both yellow leader,
yes.
And also instructor.
Affirmative. Yes, I was.
Those were your two jobs?
Those are my two jobs, yes.
Which did you prefer?
Oh, that's a difficult. I was committed and very happy to be yellow leader. But on the other hand, when one was, before the squadron was operational, and remember it took 6 weeks to 2 months from May the 15th to get it operational, I was incredibly hard working, I hope, working at getting them trained to flight perfection, put it that way. I may say that Boozy Kellett also one day played a trick on me. He didn't return from lunch, you see. And of course the afternoon's flying program for these students was due to start at 1:30. 1:30 wasn't there. 1:35, I thought, oi, oi. But started to brief the people to make sure they knew what they'd got to do in the afternoon. At 1:40, I'd authorised their takeoff myself. And at 1:45, he turned up and said, oh, well done. And I suddenly realised I'd been tested to see whether I would get on with the job. And that was the sort of man, I told that story at his funeral. And that was the sort of man he was. He was also very nice. And when I was in hospital in 1995, he used to phone Thelma every night and say, how's that young man of yours? Very nice.
During the Battle of Britain,
yes.
How at that time, how did you feel it was going?
Well, I was aware that this was simply the preliminary stages. But then remember, I had lived in a military atmosphere all my life with my father, you see, being in the army. And I was, you might say, frustrated that we were not quite having as much success intercepting these German reconnaissance aeroplanes as we might have hoped. On the other hand, I was conscious that they were exceedingly skillful in evasion. and that we would be lucky to get one. And we were. We only got them by luck.
So your squadron wasn't in that famous occasion when they were intercepted coming from Norway?
That was on August the 15th, and that was later. 249 was not involved in that. 249, I think, had gone south by then, just gone south.
Did you go south with them?
No, I did not. I was, as I say, I was held on the ground. I did not. And indeed, just about that time, as my head was not healing as they hoped, I was sent on holiday with my wife and children, wife and boy, to the seaside and told to swim every day. And of course, as the nearest unmined beach was at Buckie in Aberdeenshire, they gave me the petrol to go there.
How did you feel about going to a Polish squadron?
I was very interested. I was still limited to 2,000 feet. I felt that I should be working all I could, and I found the Poles very nice. I found Rolski was particularly capable. He had been a Polish fighter pilot in the War of 21, I found that they were keen and anxious to learn. And it's always a pleasure as a teacher to work with motivated students, is it not? Yeah?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And how did the Poles feel about the policy of limited response?
They didn't know. It didn't concern them. They were just told to take off and intercept. They didn't know that sort of thing. They had so much to learn about radar, or some of the limits of radar, the observer corps, the fact that our aeroplanes not only had IFF for the radar to distinguish between British and foreign, but had this pipsqueak facility which allowed British fighter aeroplanes to be plotted wherever they might be over the United Kingdom and that sort of thing, see?
Pipsqueak,
yes. Pipsqueak was an automatic radio transmitter fitted to every fighter aeroplane on HF frequencies, which allowed the aeroplane itself to transmit for 13 seconds of a minute. And you had your pipsqueak indicator in the cockpit, and you only could transmit in the other 47 seconds. You see? So you were able to transmit when pipsqueak was not operating, and pipsqueak transmitted from either a single aeroplane or the leader of three or the leader of six or so-and-so, right? Uh-huh. And that allowed that formation to be plotted by this triangulation process, wherever it might be. This was called pipsqueak code, I think taken from the children's cartoon, Pipsqueak and Wilfred.
Any incidents you can describe with the Polish units?
Well, I think the most outstanding memory of the Polish 306 squadron was when I took Rolski and a friend up for formation practice in a hurricane, and I found that Rolski performed flawlessly.